Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the Decadal Herald and Review for Thursday, June 25, 2015. Education Coalition inspires summer learning for kindergarten. One of the main goals of the Education Coalition of Macon County is helping ensure every child is ready for kindergarten. Starting in May, EDCO handed out activity books and at pediatricians' offices, the Macon County Health Department, preschools, daycare centers, and Persian Early Learning Center. The group ordered 17,000 books in the hopes of getting one into the hands of every child who could benefit. These can go to anyone, said Principal Jason Wallace of Pershing School. They're designed to help them with words, shapes, colors, arithmetic skills. There are poems in there. Danny Kraft, Executive Director of EDCO, hopes the books will inspire parents to work with their kids at home, not only using the book, but in everyday activities. Academic skills can be incorporated into almost any activity, from going to the grocery store to sorting laundry to helping in the kitchen. Kraft said the books are based on the Common Core National Learning Standards used to measure achievement in Illinois and are also available through EDCO's website, www.edco4kids.org, or by calling 217-429-3000. Early childhood educators helped design the activities in the books right down to the sight words pages that include perforations so the individual words can be used like flashcards. It's just another way to help them get ready for kindergarten, Wallace said. Decatur's public preschool program will expand next year with 4 new classrooms at Southeast School, which formerly housed Phoenix Academy, thanks to a $20 million grant for Illinois schools that will be renewed for 4 years. The 4 new classrooms will provide seats for an additional 80 4-year-olds who will attend for full-day sessions. The program, like Pershing's, is aimed at at-risk kids. At-risk, Wallace said, includes a lot of factors, including low income and academic delays. Staff will include a parent educator and grants coordinator and raise the number of children served to 630. In Macon County, Kraft said about 53% of kids do not attend preschool or have any formal education opportunities prior to beginning kindergarten. Unless parents work with those kids to develop the skills they'll need for school, those kids will be at a distinct disadvantage academically. EDCO is also working on some initiatives for older students to help them be college and career ready, including a math boot camp that will show high school students practical applications for math while giving them experience and soft skills like being on time and dressing professionally. Stabbing victim had been checking on neighbor. Police say a Decatur man's good deed was punished with life-threatening multiple stab wounds Tuesday afternoon. His alleged assailant, John A. Morton, 49, was booked into the Macon County Jail on a charge of attempted murder after he allegedly stabbed the Good Samaritan who stopped by his home to check on his welfare. The 57-year-old victim suffered a knife wound to his neck, 2 wounds to his back, and a stab wound in his left arm. Police say he tried to flee after the assault, bleeding heavily, collapsed in the roadway in the 1700 block of South 33rd Street. He was rushed to St. Mary's Hospital, and sworn police statements say he was in critical condition. A doctor advised that his wounds were life-threatening and that he required emergency surgery for treatment, police said. Police said the victim knew Morton slightly, and the victim's wife had mentioned to him that she had noticed the grass in Morton's yard was getting very tall. She asked if anyone was checking on his welfare, Police Detective James Atkinson wrote in a sworn statement. Interviewed while doctors treated him, the victim told police he had called on Morton, who also goes by the name Patrick Ewing, and told him that he had just stopped by to check on him. The victim stated that Pat responded that he did not need to be checked on, Atkinson told police. He stated that Pat then began stabbing him. Officers found a blood trail leading from Morton's house, and they said Morton still had blood stains on his fingers when they questioned him. Then they seized a blood-stained knife that Morton had tucked into his pants pocket. Witnesses confirmed watching a physical altercation take place between Morton and the victim in Morton's front yard. Morton is being held without bond and is due in court July 1st. Rural Transit Committee Chairman resigns, Decatur. Switching to quarterly meetings did not give members of the Macon County Rural Transit Advisory Group any more time to talk about. Adjournment Wednesday came in less than 13 minutes and came immediately after Group Chairman Mark Wicklund announced he is resigning his position with the group effective today. Wicklund said he wrote his role as board president of Decatur-Macon County Opportunities Corporation is taking more of his time. "We have a lot of great projects at DMCOC going on," he said. "We're also having some state funding problems and trying to keep an eye on that pretty close." Wicklund was picked by former Macon County Chairman Jay Dunn, Democrat Decatur, to lead the Transit Advisory Group when it was organized in 2012. But meetings have been plagued by poor attendance and the group has had difficulty achieving a quorum. The group had a quorum, however, at meetings in January, February, and March, and again on Wednesday when Becky Gillen officially took her seat on the committee. She is starting point director for Macon County Health Department and replaces Marilyn Piasecki, who resigned her position as information specialist for Starting Point, and thus her position with the advisory group. Her last meeting was February 25th. Wicklund had been promising information on serving the so-called gray areas of Macon County, suburban areas of Decatur not served by Decatur Public Transit or ShowBus, the county's public transportation provider in rural areas. He told group members Wednesday he believes service in those areas is feasible by the end of 2015, but gave no specifics. "I see nothing but great things to come for rural transportation in Macon County," Wicklund said. The gray areas include Forsyth and parts of Harristown, Long Creek, Mount Zion, and Oriana. County Board Chairman Kevin Greenfield, Republican Decatur, said in a telephone interview, he plans to have Wicklund's replacement ready to lead the group's next meeting September 23rd, and that he will consult with County Engineer Bruce Bird and group members in making the choice. Ridership figures presented Wednesday by ShowBus Director Laura Dick show the number of rides given on the decline, with 732 in March, 715 in April, and 674 in May. Park District Program Drives for Young Golfers. "When Riley Hauser's dad first introduced her to golf, she wasn't exactly into it. I thought, oh, Dad, I don't want to go out there. I don't think I like this," she said. But 5 years later, the 13-year-old from Mount Zion was gamely honing her putting skills on a bright sunny day at Hickory Point Golf Course as part of the Decatur Park District's Junior Golf Academy. The key, Riley said, was when she learned that she liked driving, especially seeing whether she could hit the ball farther than her father. Now the family practices together and Riley hopes to make the high school team next year. She disagrees with other kids her age who think sport is boring. "It is boring to watch on TV. Even I don't like to watch it on TV," she said. "But whenever you're actually out here, it's more fun because you can actually try to focus on the shot." About 65 young golfers between the ages of 5 and 17 are taking part in the junior golf program this summer, said Kurt Rogers, manager of the golf for the district. The program runs on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but its first session, June 16th, was canceled because of wet weather. Nationally and in Decatur, the number of golfers have declined since the 1990s. Rogers and the other golf pros hope they can still instill a love of the sport in young children, creating a new generation of golfers. 8 or 9 is the time we have to sort of snag them, because that is when they start soccer and baseball and all the other things that are dragging them away from golf, Rogers said. Of course, the sport can appeal even to very young children. The group of 5 to 7-year-olds appeared enthralled by their practice with hitting balls Tuesday. After about 30 minutes, the grass in front of them was dotted with so many yellow balls that it looked like an Easter egg hunt. One of the youngest golfers was Xander Thomas, 5, who has been taking part in golf lessons at the Decatur Indoor Sports Center for about 2 years. His parents, Greg and Jan Thomas, said Xander likes meeting the other kids. The goal is for him to be able to play with his dad someday. Youngsters can still sign up for the remainder of the Junior Golf Academy, which runs until the end of July. Call Hickory Point at 217-421-7444. Chad Cutler jury begins murder trial deliberations, Decatur. The 8 men and 4 women serving on the jury in the trial of Chad M. Cutler began their deliberation Wednesday afternoon following closing arguments. Associate Judge James Coryell gave them the choice of going home immediately at 3:45 p.m. or deliberating as long as they wanted, even if it meant staying late into the evening. After deliberating for about 70 minutes, they decided to break for the day. Cutler, 39, was returned to jail, where he has been held on $5 million bond since his arrest August 8, 2013, charged with the murder of his 47-year-old wife, Lisa Cutler, a Spanish teacher at Eisenhower High School. She drowned in the bathtub in the master bedroom in their Mount Zion home the night of April 26, 2012. In his closing argument, Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott said the marriage between the defendant and Lisa Cutler was not a happy one. Lisa suffered from anxiety and depression. The defendant suffered from alcoholism, Scott said, as he stood at a podium facing the jurors. A white mannequin dotted with stickers marking 23 wounds found on the victim's body was standing behind him. The bathtub where she drowned sat in front of the defense table. Scott and Lisa Cutler filed for divorce in February 2012. The family's finances were in shambles, with debts totaling them $450,000. While she was the sole breadwinner, earning about $44,000 annually. The situation heated up on April 18, 2012, the day Chad Cutler opened an email account in his wife's name and then used it to purchase two accidental life insurance policies, both of which named him as the sole beneficiary in case of her death. One was for $500,000, the other for $200,000. Prosecutors focused a lot of attention on Cutler's efforts to obtain insurance policies during the trial to help establish his motive, as well as premeditation and planning of the murder. Cutler is charged with three counts of first-degree murder. The first count requires that the jurors find that Cutler intended to kill his wife or cause great bodily harm. If Cutler is convicted on this count, jurors are then to decide if the murder was committed in a cold, calculated, and premeditated manner according to a preconceived plan. If jurors affirm that enhancement, Cutler will be eligible for a life sentence without parole. Without a finding of premeditation, he is facing 20 to 60 years in prison. The other two counts have slightly lower standards for conviction, not requiring intent, but he knew he was causing her death or that there was a strong probability of causing her death. Scott said evidence showed Chad Cutler set up the email account, lisa.cutler@ymail.com, while his wife was at her workplace. The internet service provider address traced to the setup time and place was the Cutler home. He was unemployed at that time. Every email sent to and from that address had to do with life insurance policies, with the exception of one in which Chad Cutler inquired about software for scrubbing a computer hard drive. When Illinois State Police investigators questioned him the night following Lisa Cutler's death, Chad Cutler told him that he didn't have access to it because he forgot the password. It was ludicrous to claim that a woman who was divorcing her husband, who was going to move on with her life, was going to set up a life insurance policy with her soon-to-be ex-husband as the sole beneficiary, Scott told the jurors. April 21st was a big day for Chad Cutler. He applied and was approved for a $200,000 policy with one company. He also received approval for a policy with a $500,000 payout that day, effective April 25th. Then Lisa had a few more days to live, Scott said. He reminded jurors that witnesses testified that Lisa Cutler told them she was afraid that Chad Cutler would kill her. Chad Cutler also provided evidence of his possible intentions in a January 15, 2012 entry in his journal found on his nightstand. Chad Cutler wrote, "I don't blame her for her fear. She has got to stop or she has to go." In his argument, defense attorney Jeff Justice said that while prosecutors presented records of emails and data from two cell phones, they failed to present all the information related to a prepaid cell phone Lisa Cutler had purchased. "Where is the data?" Justice asked, adding that the phone had internet access, but no information on its internet activity had been presented. Justice, who presented a forensic pathologist Wednesday, who said his opinion was that the death resulted from a fall in the tub from a sitting position following a seizure, said the testimony of the state's expert was contradictory. He said Dr. Mary Case testified that clonazepam, an anti-anxiety drug used by Lisa Cutler for several years, does not break down after death. The defense expert, Dr. David Posey, agreed with that. However, the state's rebuttal witness, forensic toxicologist Dr. Bruce Goldberger asserted that the drug did break down after death. Justice said that every single doctor who testified said sudden withdrawal from clonazepam leads to seizures. In her rebuttal closing argument, First Assistant State's Attorney Nicole Kroenke said the opinions of all the state's six expert witnesses clashed with the opinion of Posey, who was testifying for the first time in a drowning death. The state experts, including nationally recognized experts in aquatic deaths, forensic pathology, and toxicology, testified that Lisa was forcibly held down by an external force. Force was applied to her head. Some individual other than herself caused Lisa's death. The manner of death was homicide. Kroenke commented on Posey's theory in which Lisa Cutler, who supposedly entered the whirlpool tub because of back pain, was sitting in the middle of the tub straight up, rather than leaning against the side where the water jet discharged water. A Bible and cell phone were found in the tub, indicating the type of activity one would associate with leaning against the tub. Then she suffered massive injuries, including an elbow hemorrhage described internally as a lake of blood and five head bruises, by falling 6 to 18 inches backward against the side of the tub. Besides the short distance of that kind of fall, any fall into a full tub would be cushioned by the water. She wouldn't have suffered abrasions of her elbows with a slight backward fall into a full tub. This is absolutely unbelievable, Kroenke said. Police make three arrests in shooting spree. Decatur. Police have arrested three Decatur men Tuesday in a bid to stamp out ongoing street battles involving gunmen firing multiple shots at each other. Police investigations highlight three exchanges of fire on city streets that took place June 19th, June 4th, and May 18th. It's alleged that one of those arrests Tuesday, 18-year-old Kyle J. Akbar, took part in all three incidents. He was booked into the Macon County Jail on charges that included three counts of aggravated discharge of a weapon and multiple counts of aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. Also arrested Tuesday were Anthony S. Rimes, 22, and Mark G. Hyder, 19. Rimes is charged with aggravated unlawful use of a weapon and aggravated discharge of a weapon for allegedly exchanging gunfire with Akbar on June 4th. Hyder faces a charge of aggravated discharge of a weapon and being a felon in possession of a weapon after police say he exchanged fire with Akbar on May 18th. Police Chief Brad Sweeney said Akbar's arrest was carried out by his officers, assisted by members of the U.S. Marshals Service. Decatur detectives took the other two suspects into custody. Akbar was allegedly armed with a stolen 9mm handgun linked to multiple shootings, and a second firearm was recovered after Rimes and Hyder were apprehended. Sweeney said more arrests were likely as law enforcement cracks down on the recent spate of street violence. The Decatur Police Department is hopeful the recent arrests are the beginning of the end to this feud between the young men, Sweeney said. Sworn police statements offered more detail about each of the shootings. The May 18th incident took place in the 900 block of East Lincoln Street and resulted in a friend of Akbar being shot in the hand. Police allege Akbar pulled out his handgun and exchanged multiple shots with Hyder. The statements say that June 4th shooting appeared in the 1000 block of North Union Street when Akbar and Rimes fired multiple shots at each other after a confrontation. It's alleged the June 19th shooting took place in the 1300 block of North Union when Akbar said a group of men arrived on bicycles and began firing at him and his friends. Kyle stated he pulled out his gun and chased the men, according to the sworn statements. Kyle stated he chased them across Grand Avenue and emptied his gun. Kyle stated he estimated he fired his gun approximately 11 times toward the men. All three suspects remain in the Macon County Jail on Wednesday in lieu of $500,000 bond each. Gamers crazy for newest release in Arkham Trilogy. Decatur. Jacob Leah and Joe Harrison arrived at GameStop on Monday afternoon, hours before the highly anticipated release of Arkham Knight, the third game in the Batman Arkham Trilogy. Harrison was decked out as the Joker, and not the Cesar Romero version of the 1960s, but the unhinged, smeared lipstick version of the dark and brooding Batman of the Arkham game world. These guys really love their games, manager Nolan Reese said. It's entertainment. These guys are going to have a lot of fun, and for fans of Batman, they like to get together and share the experience. The store put on a cookout and costume contest and had plenty of related accessories for sale, including Arkham Knight watches, figures, and a Batarang, which Leah said he bought earlier in the day. Arkham is an asylum in Batman's world where the bad guys are sent when they get caught. But some of the characters, said Jacob Ahola, who waited for his brother Eric, who was dressed as Scarecrow, became who they are as a result of their confinement in Arkham. It's a third-person game best played on a game console, as few companies have the capability of handling the intense graphics, and it's played alone, not online against other players. The previous games are Arkham Asylum and Arkham City. Brittany Wass, dressed as Harley Quinn, said she expected to be up most of the night playing her game. I have an 8 o'clock class, she said. I may not make it to class. No one dressed as Batman, though, not because they don't like the character. Few people have the body for Batman, Harrison said. It's also a hard costume to do. Harrison's Joker outfit, complete with green hair and purple gloves, and Watts' Harley Quinn, earned them gift cards when Reese asked the rest of the patrons to judge by applause. Scarecrow won a gift card, too. Reese said the store has plenty of the game in stock. The game sells for $59.99. We now have an editorial. Approach Wildlife Park with caution. A Moultrie County panel is taking a cautious approach to a proposal to build a new wildlife park in the county. That's the same approach that should be taken by the county board's planning and zoning committee and ultimately the entire county board. Developer James Aikman of Arthur wants to buy about 140 acres near the Great Pumpkin Patch and develop it into a wildlife park. The park would exhibit wild and exotic animals. It's expected the visitors would drive through a good portion of the park, but there also may be a part of the project that resembles a zoo. The list of animals in the project is still undergoing work, but Aikman's plants, have mentioned kangaroos, zebras, and ostriches. Aikman believes the park would be a tourist attraction. That's also the fear of 16 nearby homeowners who have banded together to stop Aikman's plans. The landowners claim that the park could easily destroy their land values, and they fear the existence of wild animals in the area. Last week, the county's Planning and Zoning Board of Appeals voted against recommending a special use permit of the Aikman Wildlife Adventure Project. Opponents of the project focused on issues of public safety, drainage of the property, and the effect of what is considered prime farmland. One of the attorneys representing the opponents probably summed up the issue best when he said that Aikman has a great idea but lacks a specific plan. For example, although Aikman has discussed drainage issues with the affected districts, he hasn't submitted a plan for their review. Aikman wants a special use permit so he can proceed with the drainage plan, which can be expensive to acquire, needs to come first. Aikman has also said that he plans on using about 45 acres of the site initially, but wants the entire 140 acres approved so he can avoid lengthy approval processes in the future. Some members of the Planning and Zoning panel also questioned the lack of a more detailed construction plans. The county has every reason to be deliberate with its approval. Aikman certainly has a vision of what the finished project will look like. No one wants to trample on someone's dream of what might be successful. But moving the project from dream to reality takes a considerable amount of planning and preparation. While Aikman's eagerness is understandable, caution is probably the best path. In order to be successful, Aikman is going to have to develop that detailed plan. It's better for all involved if he does it sooner rather than later. Remove Confederate flag from public grounds. When I went off to college in 1972, leaving Texas for New England, I took something to remind me of home, a large Confederate flag. With my roommate's indulgence, it hung on the wall of my freshman dorm suite the entire academic year. It seemed harmless at the time. I didn't intend any racial message, and I didn't feel any sympathy for racial bigotry. Although I had attended segregated schools all my life, when my high school integrated my senior year, I co-chaired a student human relations committee to address racial conflicts. Like a lot of people below the Mason-Dixon line, white people anyway, I saw the emblem as a token of regional pride. I didn't revere slavery and Jim Crow, but I thought there was much about the South to love. and if the flag annoyed the Yankees a little, that was okay. They were not as noble and blameless as they pretended to be. They were not going to make me repudiate my native region. But when I recently ran across a photo of me and a friend hanging the flag out the dorm window, I winced. The banner, the familiar red rectangle with a blue X, hadn't changed, but my understanding of what it signified had. In 2015, anyone displaying that flag knows what it means to viewers, particularly black ones. It's an expression of hostility, not only toward black people, but to broader ideals of how the nation should come to terms with the legacy of racism. It's a gesture of defiance by many whites who feel victimized by the growing visibility and influence of minorities. It's a giant middle finger aimed at anyone who would find it offensive. In a free society, expression of that sort is protected, so it's not surprising to know that the flag can be seen in many places in the South. But it is jarring to be reminded that it still flies at the state capital of South Carolina. There it's justified as a tribute to the state's Civil War heritage and history. Except it's not, really. The flag didn't fly over the state capitol until the early 1960s, and it was revived in direct reaction to the civil rights movement. It was a token of white attachment to segregation. South Carolina's impulse was not unique in the South. In 1956, Georgia changed its state flag to incorporate the Confederate flag. In Texas, at least, there was a fad of naming schools after Robert E. Lee, another coded message. Dylan Roof, the accused shooter in the June 17th massacre of the 9 parishioners at a black church in Charleston, had a car with a Confederate flag license plate. It's not hard to guess why. He was a white supremacist flaunting a symbol of white supremacy. South Carolinians and others have been arguing over this flag for years. In 1999, the NAACP mounted a campaign to boycott the state as a protest of the state capitol display. The city's mayor urged its removal. The legislature agreed that instead of flying over the building, it would hang at a monument to Confederate soldiers on the grounds. But that mild concession was not enough to satisfy NAACP Governor Nikki Haley, finally relented this week to reopen the issue. It arose in the 2000 GOP presidential primary when George W. Bush and John McCain refused to utter a bad word about the Capitol flag, insisting it was something for South Carolinians to decide. But there is no way to justify its continued place of honor in Columbia. Getting rid of it would be a step toward acknowledging that the history many South Carolinians revere was oppressive, but brutal and unconscionable. Its enduring fallout is a burden on whites as well as blacks. After losing the 2000 primary, McCain admitted he was dishonest in defending the flag. But he didn't just reverse the position he had taken to win votes in South Carolina. The Arizona senator said his Confederate ancestors fought on the wrong side of American history. "I don't believe their service, however distinguished, needs to be commemorated in a way that offends, that deeply hurts, people whose ancestors were once denied their freedom by my ancestors." McCain didn't force South Carolina's defenders of the flag to admit the obvious. Maybe Dylan Roof will. This has been Mary Mortland reading the Decatur Herald and Review for Thursday, Part 1, for Thursday, June 25, 2015. We will resume with Part 2 in the obituary shortly.